Good morning. My name is Steve Brandl. You're listening to WDRT. The name of our show is Conversations. Happy that you can tune in this morning, WDRT 91.9 FM in Viroqua. We'll also be archiving and streaming this. If you want to listen to it later or send it to friends, just go to wdrt.org, go over to archives. You can find us in Conversations and listen to it again or share it with friends. But today, I'm excited to have a guest on, and we're going to be talking about investments and retirement planning. So Allison Mendoza is joining us. She's a financial advisor from LPL Financial. Allison, welcome.
Thank you so much, Steve. Glad to be here.
Yeah, we're glad to tackle this this big, scary subject that a lot of people have a lot of anxiety about, and that's investment and 401ks and retirement and when do I start and where do I start and that sort of thing. So we're going to keep this, investment and retirement 101. So again, Allison, tell us more about yourself. Tell us about where you come from and what got you to the Driftless.
Yeah, thanks, Steve. Again, my name is Allison Mendoza. I live here in town in Viroqua, Wisconsin. I love this community. I did grow up in the Midwest in Minneapolis to a very blended, lower middle class family, and found my way out east to escape the snowy winters down to Southern Florida for about 10 years in my mid-20s to mid-30s. And that's where I kind of dipped my toe into the financial waters. I was doing basically business planning and business-to-business loan products, and was really starting to understand what finance was about in a very slim perspective. But I really missed home, and so I came back to the Midwest in Minneapolis in 2014 and found my way southeast to Driftless, Wisconsin, and fell in love. And bought a home here in 2018 and have really set down roots. I joined the personal finance realm in 2017 with my former colleague, Bill Neal. He started the firm Socially Responsible Retirement Strategies here in town and in La Crosse, and it really was a serendipitous meeting and a very perfect fit for what I was looking for and for what he was looking for.
Nifty.
Yeah.
So you two worked together for a while or something like that?
We did, yes. I had recently been laid off, I think it was like early 2017, and a former colleague of his left the firm. And so he was looking for someone, and we had a chance meeting. It clicked and it worked, and I joined his firm that summer. And it very quickly became obvious to us both that there was a future for me to take the firm over from him and allow him to retire. And that officially happened in 2021.
Okay. And that is the Bill Neal from Symphony Sunday here on WDRT. Is that the same?
That is the famous William Neal.
Wow.
Yes.
And you said he moved on and recently moved out east.
That's correct. He officially retired last November 2023. And him and his wife, Pam, purchased a home in rural Virginia.
Okay. And living the life in the sunny southeast, huh?
Yeah, they have this beautiful property, about 2 acres, lots of woods, Amish nearby. So it has kind of those Driftless roots, but out east where many of his siblings and children live as well.
Wonderful. And so getting back to your interest in financial management and things, it's interesting that you'd have that interest and dedicate your life to it, because so many of us are just terrified of it. And how did that come about? Like, what other interests do you have? Are you like a math person or what?
I actually very much enjoyed math growing up. I kind of hit it too, but yes, math has always come quite easy to me. I have a very analytical brain. But I also, started working in, customer service and hospitality, as a teenager in my 20s, because I loved working with people. I loved having conversations and understanding that. Finance kind of came in a little bit later into my life. Growing up, we didn't talk about money. You could tell that the bills got paid, but there wasn't a lot of extra. And yeah, it just wasn't something that was discussed. I kind of think of the ethos growing up was you can't take it with you, so spend it while you have it. You know, we definitely lived paycheck to paycheck. You know, when I went off to college, it was I had saved up a decent amount of money, but it didn't last long because college is expensive. And, you know, I quickly learned the dark side of finance. You know, your first couple weeks on campus and there's pretty aggressive applications, requests to be filled for credit cards. And then a couple weeks later, credit cards come in the mail and it's like gifts from God.
Manna from heaven.
Exactly. And yeah, I didn't know much about budgeting and paying and debt and all of that stuff. Even though I was fairly good with numbers, that part of my life was very much disorganized. And I found myself in my mid to late 20s, you know, fairly in a decent amount of debt through school, through medical bills, through credit card debt. And I was in school at the time going to be a paralegal. I thought, you know, maybe I'll end up being an attorney. We'll kind of take, you know, the gradual way to see if that works for me. And I actually ended up filing bankruptcy by myself in my mid-20s. It was, surprisingly, though, my financial education. That was my 101. They forced you to go through financial education to do that. And it was something clicked in me. I was like, this is how it works. I didn't know how it works. And I was able to find some clarity and understanding that, yeah, the interest, paying the minimum payment on my credit card bills for the last, you know, 5-7 years wasn't working for me. And the bills kept getting bigger, and I never understood why. Going through that process was a great financial education for me. And following that, I finished school, and I worked for the government for a short period of time before joining this firm that was small. And again, it was business finance, and I was able to really kind of understand running a business because, you know, I was helping the founder run day-to-day operations, balance budgets. I was kind of like a pseudo CFO there for a while as we were growing. And that was also very helpful to me in my career, being able to, you know, manage assets for investors. You know, they were privately investing in this business and being able to understand how that all worked. But then there was also the second side of it, and that was working with small businesses and really helping them, you know, generate capital to expand or to make payroll or small, simple things. And I enjoyed that a lot.
Your customer base now, is it business clients that you're assisting in business consulting, or is it individual people and their needs to, you know, live life, finance, get on a budget, invest, and retire? Is there a typical, or is it all?
It is all of the above. So the primary base of our clientele is, you know, families. It is, you know, the personal investor saving for retirement, managing their retirement assets. It is, you know, the young families who have kids that are just, you know, making sure they're saving enough for them for college. But we do also help small businesses, nonprofits. We help them manage their 401ks or qualified retirement plans. I don't do business consulting as it kind of is a gray area in terms of being an investment advisor, but I can help businesses manage their assets and manage cash flow. But our primary base is, you know, individual investors who are planning for retirement and for, you know, specific financial goals.
Mm-hmm. Okay. The conversation that we're going to have today is really based on family finances and investments and retirement planning and things like that. So, oh my goodness, where do we start? So, you know, what happened? And I'm thinking of breaking this down into, you know, talking about families and folks that are in their 20s and 30s, and the next category is 40s and 50s, and then 60s and 70s. Like, tell us more. Let's start with a young family or a young person themselves. They come to you. They're 20 or in their 20s or 30s or something like that. Where do you start when you're that age?
A lot of the times, you know, it comes down to younger folks thinking that they have time to save later. So often it is, you know, focusing on budgets. And I'll just say this, no matter 20, 40, 60, 80 years old, you know, that is the biggest portion or the most challenging aspect of this is budgeting. No one likes to, you know, balance their checkbook every day. No one wants to adhere to, you know, making sure they're staying within their budget for their groceries this week. That is the most challenging aspect of any retirement plan for most people. Don't get me wrong, there are some people who are very diligent about it, and they're far, you know, far ahead of the rest of us. But I would say 20s and 30s, depending on whether they're single or married, it really comes down to trying to incorporate the structured savings process. So whether people are working part-time, still in school, you know, or taking care of children at home and maybe only one spouse is working, we really try to establish a savings plan for everyone in the family. And that can be anywhere from $5 a month, you know, to maxing out your 401k. The process is more or less trying to instill that practice of saving each time you get paid so that you're strengthening that habit for the future in the long haul. So that tends to be, you know, someone in their 20s and 30s, it's more like, do you have a handle on your budget? How much, you know, do you have debt? What are your liabilities look like? You know, are you saving for retirement in terms of, you know, an employer-sponsored 401k plan or an IRA? Do you have an emergency savings account? So those are the things that we really want to dive into initially, because I feel like those habits, if you can start them earlier, will only prove to be more valuable the older that you become.
Mm-hmm. And are most most employers do a 401k? And is that the carrot on the stick, or one of the, you know, as the employee market gets tighter, are there more saving and investing benefits through a lot of workplaces?
It is common for employers to offer that, but it really depends on the structure and size also of the institution that you're working for. And recently in 2020 and 2021, Congress passed what's called the SECURE Act, which is going to make it a lot easier and economically beneficial for employers to begin those retirement plans. They'll receive tax credits. They already receive tax credits if they're, you know, matching in the of their employees. It's not all businesses, but a great deal of them do offer. And of course, you know, most employers with, you know, 50 or above employees are going to be offering that as an added benefit. There are options to save for retirement outside of that if your employer does not.
Right. And let's talk about that, because there's a ton of folks in the drift list that, you know, one or the other spouse is home with the kids and someone has their own business. So you're out there and you have your own business, be that construction or whatever it is. What are some strategies there for that family that's trying to build a business and take care of kids and things? Anything right off the cuff that is typically done right or wrong in those situations?
More or less, I would say that the first step is opening yourself an individual retirement account or an IRA. And there is a couple options. You either have a pre-tax or a Roth option. Pre-tax is going to be tax deductible from your income. So that's something that can be beneficial to, you know, sole proprietors or sole business owners. They can give themselves a tax deduction, and they can also contribute for their spouse as well. So even if one spouse is staying at home, if the other spouse has earned income, you can contribute for both. So that's kind of like the low-hanging fruit. It's not a great deal that you can save each year. We're talking about maybe $6,000 or $7,000, which could seem like a lot to some, don't get me wrong, but that ceiling for contribution is much lower than others. So I'd say that's probably the first place to start and to think about. There are other options in terms of like solo 401ks and SEP IRAs, which get a little more complicated, but we'll keep it simple to that. You know, the individual retirement account or IRA is a great option to just start, even if your employer doesn't offer you a qualified retirement plan. That's a great place that you can get your foot in the door and start saving and practicing that structured payment.
And that's a 10. So again, help me out because I'm no expert on this at all.
Sure.
So let's just say we're making $50,000 a year,
mm-hmm.
and you can legally do an investment like that for $8,000. Does that mean that's pre-tax? So that would, you know, when you're doing your taxes, $50,000 less $8,000, so you'd only be taxed on $42,000 at that point?
Correct. Theoretically, it's a little bit grayer than that, depending, you know, want to, you know, consult with a CPA exactly. It's not always dollar for dollar, but it's very close.
Okay.
So yes, it is going to reduce your earned income that you're paying taxes on.
So then you don't pay that tax now, but you will when you pull it out later in life?
That's correct. When you do take withdrawals older in retirement, then it is fully taxed at that time. It's considered taxable income.
Okay. And how locked away is that? So, you know, if you needed an emergency fund and you had to lean on that later, is it just straight you pull it out and you have to pay tax on it, or is there like a penalty or something for doing that?
This is a great question. It's a little bit of both. So technically, you're not supposed to take withdrawals earlier than 59 and a half. But there are some, you know, rules to allow you to do that. If you're a first-time home buyer, you can take a withdrawal, that's not penalized. If you're, you know, have been laid off and you're in economic hardship, that's considered an exception. And I think there's also a healthcare exception as well. But ultimately, you can take the money out. You do pay taxes on it as its income, but you will basically avoid the 10% penalty that the IRS will add to that if you take it before 59 and a half.
Okay. Right.
Yeah.
And anything else at that age that should be a consideration or?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, like, again, minimizing any revolving debt can be key. Again, you want to make sure that, like I said, you're just starting to think about and make sure that you're structuring those planned savings. I'd say that's the first and foremost. And yeah, just try to practice living within a budget.
Right. And this is something that you do work on.
Yep.
Is that so you have clients and they come in the similar situation that we just outlined and things? And
yes.
And how... What's the fee for service? Is it a percentage? Is it are you presented with a bill when, or as a consultant, or how do you charge?
Great question, and it's actually a little bit of both. So me as a independent advisor, I'm a fiduciary, and so I am ethically bound to put in your considerations as a client. If you're a potential client, Steve, and you came to me saying I need help, I've got questions. I basically take all of my clients through the financial planning process, and there's a number of reasons behind that, and I'll get into that in a moment. But I am paid an hourly fee for financial planning consulting. That's so that I can offer advice to you as a client that is in your best interest. It's, you know, much like an attorney. I can't offer advice that's unsolicited. We have to have a financial arrangement for that. The other way that I am paid is through a percentage or flat-based fee on assets under management. And that's how I'm primarily paid through all of my clients. The financial planning process is, you know, 3 to 5 hours of us talking about, you know, what you have, your income, your expenses, your assets, your liabilities, your goals. You know, and really structuring what makes sense to accomplish those short-term, mid-term, and long-term goals. And so it's a process of, you know, figuring out what percentage you're paying on your mortgage, and does it make sense for you to pay more, or do you have student loans, and or is it a good time to sell your house? You know, we're really diving into each individual person's assets and in their lifestyle to understand how we can, you know, make the best recommendation. At the end of that financial planning session is, yes, when you're presented with an hourly bill, you know, the things that we worked on, and an implementation plan. And then it would be your discretion whether you wanted to implement the recommendations that have been suggested. And then the other way that I'm paid is by assets under management. So I'd say 90% of our clients, they are, you know, they hold advisory accounts with us, meaning that we're using a limited discretion to trade on market conditions, rebalance accounts, cash management, and they're paying us a flat fee under 1% to manage those assets. indefinitely until they either choose to, you know, move to another advisor or liquidate their assets, which, you know, it happens from time to time.
Mm-hmm. So that then, is there like a threshold where it's generally you got to have whatever, $100,000 worth of assets or something like that?
Great question. It really depends on the type of investment. The previous threshold is about $25,000. But who I work with, LPL Financial, has lowered a lot of those minimums down to like $10,000 now. So that I can offer an advisory relationship at a lower threshold. Because again, we want to open the doors to those that maybe don't have, you know, a great deal of assets or just accumulating assets. And that way we can offer those benefits to more people.
Right. Well, that seems reasonable. I mean, do you have an annual review or biannual, or how does that work?
I'm fiduciary, so I'm responsible to meet with all of my advisory clients at least once a year, but we do try to meet twice a year. Spring and fall is really when we reach out to our clients to check in with them. And it's really all based around financial planning. I really find it challenging to manage investments for someone that I don't understand, you know, what their lifestyle is like, what their goals are. So I really push financial planning. And so in those reviews, it's half and half. It's half, let's review your investments, how they're doing. You know, is there anything that's standing out that, you know, doesn't jive with you? And the second half is financial planning, you know, updating balances, you know, seeing if there's any expenses that are coming down the pipeline, whether it's a new car or, you know, got to replace, you know, the furnace and things like that. And so it's that two, it's the, you know, half and half of that, really working to understand where the client's at and what they need in order to continue to manage the assets appropriately.
And fiduciary, what does that mean?
It means that I am ethically bound. I basically have said that I will put my client's interests ahead of mine.
Thank you, Allison, for all the information you're providing for us. You're listening to WDRT 91.9 FM. The name of the show is Conversations. My name's Steve Brandl. I am your host today, and Allison Mendoza, financial advisor, is our guest. So again, Allison, thank you for being a part of today's show. Back from our break, back with Allison Mendoza. And before the break, we were talking a little bit about the difference between, you know, just a traditional stockbroker and retirement planner. And Allison, is there a difference, or what is that difference? And is it a legal description, or how does that work?
There is a difference. And yes, there is a legal difference in terms of how each is licensed. So typically, stockbroker is something that people think of, yeah, managing assets. There's also financial planner, which they don't have to have managed assets and they don't have to be licensed. And then there's a full advisor, investment advisor. And so the basic difference is a broker is very transaction-based. They're the ones that are executing trades based on a client's discretion. So a lot of times stockbrokers don't have the discretion to make trades at will, again, because they're transaction compensated. A financial planner, again, is going to be more into the planning side, understanding more of goals, financial needs, assets, saving structures, withdrawal structures. And then an advisor encompasses both of those, and think of them more as like a complete financial picture advisor. They usually work in concert as well with a tax advisor, client's tax advisor as well, to help mitigate any, you know, tax mistakes. And so those are the basic structures. And so I do get often asked if I'm a stockbroker. And technically, I am. Yes, I make trades for my clients upon their discretion. But I consider myself more of an investment manager in terms of I'm investing on a broad spectrum. You know, those clients that, again, are stock picking themselves. I don't do stock picking. And or I'm, you know, investing more in broad mutual funds and managing a certain risk objective for a client based on their age and lifestyle.
Okay, okay. So, and you don't do insurance?
I do insurance, okay, as well, yes. That's okay. Part of the financial planning process is risk mitigation. And so we'll, you know, do some stress tests or gap analysis to decide if, you know, life insurance is needed, if, you know, some who are the sole breadwinners of their family, you know, do they need disability insurance to cover something happened to them? You know, long-term care insurance comes up a lot, you know, as our generations are getting older and People are starting to take care of their parents. So those are all things that we really dive into in the financial planning process as well.
Sure. And let's talk more about that when we get on to the retirement part of it.
Sure.
But one thing also, and you were talking about the different categories and things. I know you do a lot of call out about socially responsible retirement investment and things. Tell me what that means, and how do you decide in a world of, you know, thousands and thousands of things to invest in, how do you decide what's socially responsible?
Yeah, great question. So first and foremost, for us, socially responsible retirement strategies encompasses more of like holistic life planning, because it's, for us, it's not just here's money, let's invest it in the market and hope it does well. Again, we really want to take a full picture of our clients' lives, you know, what they do for a living, you know, what are their goals and values, you know, are they saving for their kids' college, you know, are they taking care of an elderly parent, you know, are they going to have enough for themselves? And it really comes down to the self-sufficiency status, you know, of like, of course, we all can't do this alone. We do it as a community, but we also want to make sure that we're tending our own garden. And so that's primarily the ethos of socially responsible retirement strategies, but that also encompasses the type of investments that we're looking for. So, you know, we have a lot of clients, you know, especially locally, that want to divest from certain industries. Those generally tend to be weapons, big oil, coal, defense. Sometimes pharmaceuticals or chemicals. And so we help that process along by doing the due diligence on research of certain investments. Because yes, there are thousands and thousands of investment options out there. And I wish we lived in an investment world where someone could put a stamp on something and say, this is certified ESG. Now, ESG is kind of the replacement acronym, I guess, for socially responsible investments. And what ESG stands for is environmental, social, and governance. So those are the three pillars for criteria that are used in screening certain, you know, industries, certain stocks, specific companies from being in a specific managed portfolio or mutual fund. Environmental is pretty self-explanatory. You know, are they causing pollution? Are they cleaning up after themselves? Are they, you know, taking the necessary environmental steps to be a clean, green company? Social is the piece that's more about equity and diversity. And, you know, do you have people of color and women in your, you know, C-suites or your, you know, board of directors? Are you using child labor across the world? So those are some examples of the social aspect that's also looked at in ESG. And then governance, which is kind of what people don't talk about enough, but is the most important, and that's transparency. So we want to make sure that the company is being clear and transparent about, you know, who's running the company, you know, are there subsidiaries, you know, how are they, you know, where are they sourcing their materials for their products, or, you know, that tends to be the most crucial point in understanding if a company really is adhering to environmental policies and or social policies.
And who oversees that or rates them?
So, and again, that's where it gets very murky, is because there is no technical legal rating standard for that. So look, you know, we have like an organic certified, you know, for produce. We say, yes, that's organic certified. There is no structured body or like licensed body to do that for those types of investments. So each individual mutual fund manager has a specific screen that they'll use, meaning that a company or a mutual fund manager can label a mutual fund as ESG. My job is to kind of like look through the smoke screen and see, is it really? What are the underlying holdings in it? You know, because I've had investment managers like, hey, we have this new ESG fund. And then I look and I'm like, oh, your biggest holding is ExxonMobil. That doesn't really compute. And so that's my job as an investment manager, to kind of like guide the investor and like, you know, we want to know what your values are. Like I said, some want to divest from, you know, all toxic realm of capitalism. Can be very complicated. Others have very specific needs or wants. For example, I have a client that really does not want to invest in Amazon because she works her whole life day to day fighting Amazon and supporting, you know, small businesses to compete. And so that's something that for her is a value where she wants to divest from that. You know, and again, like I feel like the standard divestment strategies typically lie around big oil and weapons. So those are the two big ones that I know a lot of clients want to step out of. And those are fairly easy to divest from.
Oh, it is. Okay, great. Yes. Well, you know, thank you, because from my own experience, and I'm 63 years old and, you know, did the thing and worked the jobs and had the 401ks and that sort of thing. And, you know, there too tried to be socially responsible, got into investments when I worked with a different person that I got connected with one of my jobs as an investment broker or in investment planning. And I thought I was going down the road of sustainable investments and things like that. And, you know, like, as we talked about, it's a big, confusing, like you said, murky area. And so I went chose certain funds and things like that. But later, after looking at it, it was weak. I mean, you know, it was like, oh, they use whatever 30% recycled caps and what they produce or something like that. And it felt like some pretty minimalist kind of and that really raises a bigger question. And I was talking to some other folks about it. You know, I think as when you're trying to do right by it and things like that, and it's kind of like you're in this world of investment where there's thousands of options, like, should you even kind of or you know, should you just focus on return, and then with that return you personally do good with the money you made, you know? And I'm sure it's a question that has no answer and things, but I'll toss it your way and just see what your thoughts are.
Yeah, that does come up quite often, Lee, too, you know? I think 10, 15 plus years ago, too, a lot of socially responsible assets weren't doing as well. They weren't as competitive. Obviously, as you know, our global crisis comes to a forefront and we see more of the environmental damage, I think people are more keen to pay attention and invest in ESG investments. So over the last 5 to 10 years, we've seen a great deal of improvement in those spaces. And it's not uncommon for ESG holdings to beat out conventional holdings. Because, you know, they are staying out of trouble, best, you know, less liabilities in terms of, you know, government fines, et cetera. And also, again, you know, that social part of it and that governance part, when they're incorporating, you know, different people outside of, you know, general white men that have run business for many a century, they tend to do better. They're more creative. They have better market opportunity. So we are starting to see that kind of turn a corner in terms of, you know, ESG investments do quite often compete with conventional. But all that to say is that it's really a personal preference. Yes, you know, people have different values around money. It can be, you know, like, let's make a lot of money and then do good. But I'll also say, too, that a newer strategy has come up in the last 5 years in terms of sustainable investing, and that's considered shareholder advocacy. And what that means is that we can't make change in these big corporations and these big companies unless we have a seat at the table. So an example of something that happened, a fund called Engine Number One, which was part of a hedge fund a couple years ago, was able to purchase enough stock at ExxonMobil to have a voting share say in their board, and was able to get, I believe, 2 or 3 environmentalists onto the board of ExxonMobil.
Awesome.
So that's just kind of an example, too, where, you know, sometimes you have to invest in quote-unquote dirty assets in order to make a change. And a lot of ESG managers will also take that into account when they invest in something. Because do they have enough weight to say, hey, we don't like A, B, and C. Can you clean those up? You know, and maybe we'll increase our investment. So in that aspect, you know, money has a decent amount of power in the direction of pushing things and corporations to do the right thing.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you for that. I mean, thank you for, you know, putting more light on the positive side of how to, you know, correctly use your investments to better the world, because it's just so tough when you're in the middle of it all and you're barely hanging on with your knowledge base and things like that. And that's why people like yourself that you know, really work in it every day are true assets to lean on when you're looking for those simpler way of doing it to do good with your money. So awesome. So let's continue on through life. And now we're in our 40s and 50s, and you know, maybe established at a job. You got some experience and things like that. Kids are in college or heading out of the house somehow or another. What changes? What new ideas? What new strategies do you come up with in that 40 to 50 year old range?
Yeah, another great question. So first and foremost, starting to become a bit more clear about retirement goals. You know, after you've been working for a couple of decades, we all have that, you know, idea or dream of, you know, what is it going to look like, you know, when we're done working? Where are we going to live? Are we going to stay here and continue to grow roots? A lot of people move somewhere warmer. So that's first, you know, is understanding more and trying to make a clearer picture of your long-term goals, because that will really just help you decide, you know, what's going to further refine your current goals. I'd say starting to fine-tune portfolios, you know, rebalance in terms of making sure that you're taking advantage of, you know, compounding interest and compounding dividends, making sure that it's well-tuned to market conditions, making sure that you're eliminating as much debt as possible. So try to be, you know, as minimal, if not little, revolving debt. Most people have mortgages at that time in their life, you know, so we don't expect that that would be paid off. But ultimately, too, we want to make sure that we're maximizing different savings buckets. And again, that includes, you know, any employee retirement, 401ks, Roth 401ks, you know, any deferred compensation plans, you know, making sure that you're, you know, if you have the option to contribute to, you know, a traditional or a Roth IRA on top of your employer contribution, we really want to make sure you're maxing out each of those buckets in the most tax-advantaged way for your family.
Mm-hmm.
And that also includes, too, you know, most people in their 30s, 40s, and 50s have growing kids. You know, what's the goals long-term for them? Some start trust accounts for their kids so they have a small nest egg when they're done with school, and or 529s, college saving plans, make sure they have a little nest egg for their children should they choose to go to college. So those are kind of the things that we really focus on in 40s and 50s. And are you saving enough for retirement, right? So, you know, the general retirement age is between 60 and 65. And sometimes that extends out to 70, 75. It really depends on the individual person and family situation. Because, again, if you started saving late, you know, you've got some catch-up to do. And so it's really taking the temperature of, you know, what does your savings plan look like? And if you had to stop working in 15, 20 years, is it enough to sustain you 15 to 20 years into retirement?
Mm-hmm. Well, awesome. Again, I want to thank Alice Mendoza for joining us today. You are listening to WDRT 91.9 FM, WDRT.org. The name of the show is Conversations. You can listen to us now as you are, and you can also find us on the WDRT's website. If you go to archives, look for Conversations, and you can listen to the show again or share it with a friend, share it with family members. And again, Allison, thank you for joining us. So we continue on through life, and now we're thinking about retirement. We're in our 60s and 70s. Again, how do you know when you have enough to retire? You know, what is that? Is it a strategy? Is it a formula? Is it a lifestyle? What do you take into account? What kind of questions do you ask your clients when they say they want to retire and you're trying to figure out if they can float the boat?
Yeah, it's really a combination of all of the above. I wish there was a simple, straightforward answer. But it really depends on lifestyle. I think that that's the biggest portion aspect of retirement and whether you're going to have enough to sustain. Because I think the biggest mistake people make when they do retire is often spending too much money too quickly. Again, sometimes boredom or just that kind of freedom aspect of retirement can get the best of us. And so I have seen a couple clients make that mistake of spending too much money too quickly, which can really hamper and limit your assets later in life. Mm-hmm. I think understanding first and foremost, again, budget, staying within the capacity of your cash flow, especially in early retirement, something to consider. We often recommend when someone's approaching retirement within about 5 years to start saving cash. And the reason behind that is we really want 2 years of living expenses in cash when you retire. And people always ask me, but why? I have retirement assets, et cetera. Well, the great thing about retirement assets is that they continue to grow tax deferred, meaning that you're not paying any income or capital gains taxes on dividends. And so it really gives that investment the time to continue to compound. When you have cash available when you retire, it really kind of gives you that extra cushion for emergencies, whether it's going to be a medical procedure that you need, dental procedure, you know, what happens if you need a new car. Again, like I mentioned, you know, if the furnace goes out, having that immediate liquidity can help you in those first couple of years of retirement. Because also retirement may fall in, you know, maybe a bear market or a recession. And if you have to pull out large chunks of cash when you no longer have that structured income coming in and the market's down, it could really put a big dent into your retirement plan. So there's a number of things that we really want to focus on, you know, towards retirement and in retirement. And cash management really is at the top of the list. Again, and that's supporting your lifestyle. Want to make sure that, yes, you can have spend money and travel if you need to, but within the means that supports your overall retirement.
Mm-hmm. And that's no magic number, that 2 years of income or 2 years of budget. That's like if you've been doing the solid job of maintaining a budget over the years, you'll be easily be able to pinpoint and know what that number is and just say, yeah, this is it, and this is what we have to live on. What about couples and, you know, like, do you see them retiring at the same time, different times? Is there an advantage to one or the other? What's working out in the big world?
Yeah, again, I don't think that there's one size fits all. Really depends on the individual family. I have had situations where, one spouse, you know, maybe has been, you know, working pretty heavy hours for the last 30 years and is ready to be done. The other spouse will take up more of a full-time aspect. It's not uncommon for both spouses to retire at the same time and kind of take that next step into, you know, the retirement phase of their life. Sometimes it depends on if kids are still in the house, if they're supporting them through college. So it really varies. Also depends, too. I have plenty of couples that are, you know, a decade or plus, age difference. And so that's going to affect the overall plan as well. And, you know, it varies. You know, people often ask me that question too, you know, oh, should we take Social Security now or should we wait till later? Again, it's a very personalized family decision, and it depends on cash flow and cash management. And again, you know, does one spouse have a bigger benefit at 70? And does it make sense for one spouse to take theirs now so that you're getting some cash flow? So I really wish there was like one size fits all, but that's where the details come into each individual plan and really understanding lifestyle and long-term goals.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And are there some like really obvious gaps? Like at this time of year, in my opinion, you know, it's February, taxes are coming up. It happens that my property insurance comes up, and my, you know, and it seems like everything is like right now, and all of a sudden it's like, wham, here's a $3,000 bill for taxes, and oh my gosh, here's a huge bill for property insurance and car insurance. And is it only me, or just are there things that people really tend to forget about when they're budgeting for retirement?
No, I think it's not just you. I definitely find spring and fall the reason why we kind of coordinate our financial planning and annual reviews around that time is for the same reason. So spring, yes, tax returns, tax bills, property taxes, and those things really come up this time of year. You know, people often call me for cash around this time as well, whether they have, you know, some tax liabilities to pay, and also in the fall, because again, people are preparing for the holiday spending season, you know, and or kids going to school. And so those two times in the year tend to be, you know, fairly busy for us. And also again, you know, budgeting, do I have enough money to cover this? You need to pull from here, you know, reallocate there. It's not just you.
Right. Coming up with a strategy and working with you as a retirement planner, is it, I guess my, you know, my general question is there generally, do couples work as a team on that, or is there usually like this person takes it or that person takes it and they're the main planner? How does that work, and how do you broach that with your partner when it's like, oh, I don't think he or she's like tuned in the way I am, and how do we talk about this, and I'm gonna drag her down and talk to Allison, or tell us about how, you know, fix our families, Allison.
Yes, I often tell people that even as a financial advisor, a lot of times I feel like I'm a family therapist. It's not uncommon. People have a lot of you know, base values around money, a lot of that they grew up with and don't quite understand. And me being the case, like not understanding about money for a long time. It's a mixed bag, really. We do prefer to have both spouses or partners in the mix when doing financial planning, because it's best when both people are on the same page. But it's very clear in other situations where one spouse is like, they're on it. They're the money manager. They're making sure that, you know, savings are in the right spot. Everyone's topping off their buckets. So it does vary. I think more and more I'm happy to see that not only is it a partner situation, but it's also a multi-generation thing. So, you know, I'd say over the last 5 years, we've really tried to incorporate also the children in the mix. And that's because either the family has started a 529 with them or a small investment account, because it has only helped them talk about money, you know, how it helps, how it hurts, and really broaching those conversations. I would say the number one thing is to be patient, which is easier said than done, especially when we're talking about money. You know, discussing fears as well as goals. A lot of people feel like there'll never be enough, you know, or, you know, you have those type of personalities where everyone saves everything and are penny pinchers and are afraid to go on that vacation they really want to go on because they're so concerned about the level of their savings. And then you have, you know, the very other end of the spectrum of those that can't save or don't save and spend everything that they have, whether willingly or non-willingly. And so I think that starting those conversations in a basic, you know, value space. What does money mean to you? We often start our conversations with new clients as like, what's your biggest fear about money? Like, what brought you here today? What was the impetus to be like, I need help with this? And sometimes it's, hey, I'm going to receive this money from a parent that passed and I have no idea what to do with money. I'm afraid I'm going to lose it all. Or, you know, hey, I got a new job. You know, I have all these great benefits. I don't know how much I should be saving. To, you know, yeah, I'm worried I don't have enough for retirement and that I've put this on hold for too long. So starting with fears around money can always be kind of like an icebreaker, and you tend to learn a lot about people that way too.
Right. Right. And I mean, that I can speak from experience because I did retire from, you know, full time working in the last year. And it was, you know, it was terrifying. And I'm very much kind of, oh, my gosh, the sky is falling and, you know, we're all going to be poor forever kind of thing. But it was extremely relieving to just do it. Just find out where you're actually at, because I think most people will find out that they're like everyone else, and it's like, yeah, we could brush it up here and got to be a little careful there, but knowing is much better than not knowing, and you'll sleep better knowing, you know, even if it's not all rosy. So if it's not all rosy, you can come up with a plan, you know, and kind of take it from there. But you did mention something, and I didn't even think about that, and I'm, you know, the whole generational thing, you know, the baby boomers, the Gen Zs, that sort of thing, and I don't want to get into that bashing or nothing like that at all, but is there generally a difference that you see in the different generations, or is it... are we all just pretty much the same and look at investment the same and retirement strategies the same? And what has your experience been?
Quite varied. Again, I have one of our newer clients is in her mid-20s, has a great job, you know, and has hundreds of thousands of dollars saved already, you know? And I'm just like, that value that, you know, she found it in herself is very different from someone else who's like, I'm 25, I have nothing, which is fine. It's just showing you that it's so varied. Mm-hmm. And again, it also depends on how the family has broached money. So I'd say late last year, I had a client come to me who their parents are still living and they're in their 70s, and they know that a great deal of money is going to come to them when their father passes. And then they have daughters and a son that are also client of ours, and they don't talk about money. And he was very nervous, but he was also looking for some advice on, do you think I should tell my children how much money is down the pipe? I see them starting to worry about if they have kids, will they have enough funds? And it was really a great conversation for all parties had, because it was able to break the ice and realize that, yes, money was never really talked about. You know, in the boomer generation, I feel like it's very close to the chest. We don't talk about how much money we have. It's a very private matter. Where I feel like the younger generations are curious and they want to know, and maybe don't really understand the values of their parents. And so even just broaching that subject to like break the ice and them talking about like, hey, this money is coming to me, this money will go to you eventually. Both parties separately came to me later saying that they were so relieved that they were able to talk about stuff that they never felt was proper. And it kind of like built this space where they could talk about the struggles around money and what does money mean and how can we, you know, do good with it, and just kind of provide some sense of relief for the children who were, you know, working their 9-to-5s, you know, getting on with their careers, starting families, but had like this impending fear that was never going to be enough because they just didn't know. Mm-hmm. So yeah, it really varies. Like I said, sometimes. I read an article, I think maybe last week, about how Gen Z is like the new like power money managers.
Oh, really?
That a good deal of them are very focused on, you know, saving and retirement and have waited to buy homes, you know, because of the timing, but also lack of inventory. And yeah, it's very interesting to see, you know, younger clients come in and
right.
have a better grip than I ever could have imagined at that age.
Right.
So.
Right. Well, that's cool, and yeah, it's interesting from generation to generation. It's, you know, it's greatly different, and it's always the same kind of all at the same time.
Yes.
So we got about 5 minutes left, Allison. So what are we forgetting to talk about? What else is there out there that we've missed today?
Well, I want to say that this does not have to be complicated. I feel like. For me also, you know, learning to be an adult and trying to manage money, the fact of saving and investments, that was like Chinese to me. It was just a foreign idea. And I feel like very much this stuff is mystified. We really try to focus on sharing the knowledge, trying to make it simpler so that you understand exactly what's going on, why you're saving in this particular manner, why it's being invested in this particular manner. And really trying to empower each of us to take control. Because, again, like you mentioned, it can be really scary without knowing. But once you know and you have that knowledge, it's very powerful and relieving to be like, okay, it's going to be all right. Which is the case more often than not if you are willing to take a look. And so, yeah, I'd say that, you know, it all can get very confusing. What's the difference between a Roth and a non-Roth and a 401k and a 403b? You know, there's so many places that you can really get lost in the weeds. But I feel like reaching out to a financial planner or investment advisor, even if, you know, you take none of their advice, you'll find some education in the process, at least about yourself and your goals, and it'll be really useful for you.
Mm-hmm. So. Well, wonderful. And you as a company, again, it's yourself, and you have some other folks that work with you?
Yes, I have an associate, Erin Englund. She's also local to the Viroqua area. We have our main office in La Crosse, Wisconsin. We will be adding another person to the team here this summer, crossing our fingers with where the job market is. But yeah, we're a growing firm, and we look to continue to expand our clients in the Midwest. We have a decent amount of clients in Madison, in Milwaukee, in Minneapolis, Winona. That was one nice thing about Bill is that, you know, he didn't, you know, he lived here for a couple of decades, but he also had a wide array of contacts and has really, you know, branched out our overall clients.
Right. And if do you have room for new folks and things?
Yes.
Or what's the proper way to contact you if they have questions?
That's a great question. And yes, we are open to new business currently right now. Like I said, we are a growing firm. Appointments are usually scheduled out right now about 4 to 6 weeks, though. We are in a busy season. The best way to reach us right now is online. You can reach us at srrs.info. That'll bring you to the website. You can fill out an inquiry, or you can call us directly if you have any questions or, you know, curious about setting up a discovery meeting and really diving into more of what we have to offer. And that direct number is 888-492-4623.
Awesome. Yeah, and you do have a great website, and they can just Google up your name, Allison Mendoza, and it's easy to find on the internet as well. So, well, again, Allison, thank you very much for coming in today. We certainly appreciate the time that you spent with us and your vast knowledge. And hopefully we have people thinking, maybe we'll come up with some new plans for new folks. So, again, thanks for coming, Allison.
Thank you so much, Steve. I really appreciate being here.